I think I'm going to need a real drink up here. Hi, this is actually my first public reading, and I'd like to thank Leslie for selecting me, though I don't know why. I mean, she's never actually read anything of mine, except for a few smutty letters that I wrote to her years ago. Earlier in the evening, people asked how Leslie and I met. We did have a very unnecessary affair when I was 18. I wanted a signature on a book, and she gave me something else. See, I'm quite nervous. We just roamed around the campus, or this little circle, for like 10 minutes, and well, no one told us it was frat rush night, and you know, you don't do those things to three gay men in a car. You're just like, So we fiend that we were lost. We're like, hi, can you give us directions to the Modern Language Association building? And you know, to our complete disappointment, you know, those frat boys knew where the Modern Language building was. I'm sorry I don't have poetry tonight. Actually, I stopped writing poetry some time ago. I do have an essay that I'd like to read. It is about my father. Oh, yeah, I can just see you groan. Another gay man writing about their father. This one is called Sire. He is the man my sisters and brothers call Dad, but who I often address as Ross or Sire in conversation. He is sire, for he sired more than 17 children. How else is one to describe producing so many children? I say more than 17 because some time ago, I met another one of my father's children, and I do not know how many more of his children are roaming North America. This encounter did not shock me, but it did surprise me, and why I reacted in such a confusing way, I do not know. A large family is clear indication that my father enjoyed sex, and sex is the only act which produces legitimate and illegitimate children. I do not judge this, for I do not have the moral authority to deem frequent sex with one's own wife and frequent sex with women other than one's own wife wrong. I am certain of this. And so I have always known my family only to include Ross's and 16 other children with whom I grew up. I do not consider Ross's other children, those with whom I did not grow up, as my family. They interest me only as biological specimen whose fate could have been mine. Considering my father's sexual appetite, this is not an entirely unlikely thing to ponder. I do not know if my sisters and brothers with whom I grew up share my sentimental definition of who comprises my family. Probably not. They have subjected themselves to other kinds of families. For some reason unknown to me, the fact that my family is large seems to rankle and rile respectable citizens. At least that is how they see themselves. Some years ago, a woman penned my brother Richard a letter scolding him for the demographics of his family. She pointed to things like contraception, economics, population density, land sustainability, and food shortages. I do not disagree with the woman. Some of her anxiety over the matters and her observations are true. Surely producing more children than one can afford, perhaps even love, might be unnerving to people who are concerned about such things. I concede that this woman has a right to think as she does, but let me tell you something about people like her. These kinds of people are very rude, and their rudeness qualifies them as bad people. And bad people, according to Western beliefs, go to hell without question, and preferably without delay. In this particular instance, Western thought is something to be admired because it gives me a petty victory. I am sure all the mean thoughts I have for this woman is in bad taste, but I like bad taste. Why I should become defensive about someone other than myself pointing out Ross's faults baffles me, for I am not partial to him, and I am not particularly protective of him. He was not and is not the kind of father about which sons daydream. I do not remember being instructed by him. Gruffing orders to perform some task is not instruction, or complimented by him. Acknowledging my presence or absence will not do. Oh, I admit I am not a good son. By his standards, I am a disappointment. More disappointing than his other sons who drink too much, who commit adultery, who eat peyote, who convert to Christianity, or who marry unsavory women. At last, these things are excusable because these other sons are skilled shepherds and ranchers and carpenters, things that matter on the reservation, things that I am not. I have no comparable skills. I can improve English grammar, but what are complete sentences compared to a well-fed cow? I'm completely shaking up here. It is a cliche to claim not to know one's parents, but how else am I to describe myself? I know this because I was schooled with people who were full of not knowing their parents. Still, this is particularly true in my case. Ross and I are separated by time and reality and language. He is 82. I am not. He trusts the goodness of living. I do not. He knows the Navajo reservation, the language and its cultural baggage. I know the Net American landscape, its language and its cultural baggage. In part, this predicament can be attributed to American history. For those of you ignorant of America and its history, and there are many of you, the American government, that is to say Americans, to be frank, white people, not so long ago decided that Native cultures were very bad and Native languages were garble, and tried to eradicate them. This valiant effort failed, and the result was people like Ross and I. This is the easy part to pinpoint. The other part, the part that involves Ross and I as human beings, as father and son, is an altogether different matter. Ross's youth, his life before me, is hazy. This haze is not uncommon between parent and child. For instance, the date of Ross's birth isn't an unreliable thing. This kind of confusion is not unusual, though. For the Bureau of Indian Affairs is notorious for clerical errors. It is likely the person who labored his life away in a BIA office simply did not know the year. And again, I say this is a generous observation on my part. As a result, Ross's birth certificate notes the year of his birth as 1921. Yet, Ross's parents told him he was born the year the stars fell. An educated guess places this during the year 1917, a year a startling meteor shower filled the night sky, which people on the mountains I come from witnessed. You may ask yourself, why am I bent by the small error in a birth record? Surely the error was not his fault, and it cannot be rectified. Well, here is this. When someone's proper age is not known as a reliable fact, then it is a very bad, or at least a small omen, that this person will always be unknowable in a small degree to himself, or to a big degree to others, perhaps to someone like his son. Somewhere between his birth and my own appearance into the world, there is this other person. Her name is Rachel. She is a woman with whom my father fell in love and married. I cannot tell if Rachel was his first love. It is unlikely, for he was 23 and she was 12 when they married. Because of her youth and her life with Ross, Rachel perhaps knew Ross best. Well, poor Mary Kay Letourneau. She followed my mother. Ross and Rachel's first meeting sounds like a cliche in Navajo life, but it is a story I was told. I was not interested in the event, rather I was curious about the bad behavior surrounding it. I was sure they behaved badly. At the time I had inquired, I was beginning to understand and trust that despite culture and geography, human beings, without question, without doubt, behave badly. Instead, Rachel told me this lean and brief and completely unsatisfactory story. Your father and I met while I was sheep herding. After that, once in a while, he would bring me candy and material for dresses. I remember he would often bring calico. Well, who can find fault with that? Ross was a young man then, working on the railroad and picking crops, traveling to places he had never been. Then he found someone with whom he desired to share his life. Nevertheless, someone did find fault. These someones were members of Ross's family. They found fault in her family. Rachel's family is a family of medicine people. Both her parents and her grandparents knew several ceremonies, chiefly the mountaintop way, the great star chant, and the water way. From what I am told, these are sort of what people would call esoteric ceremonies. Rachel's family was also notorious for its drinking. Her grandmother was half Mexican, raped by a soldier, or maybe a bandit. From then on, she was always an outlaw. She was the first person in the Chisquamalans to own a whiskey distillery. These two things, alcohol and ceremonial knowledge, when paired, place people under suspicion and scrutiny. I cannot know whether my father's family disliked the alcohol consumption or the ceremonial knowledge more. I suspect they focus on the alcohol consumption, but they dislike the ceremonial knowledge most, for Ross's family has no ceremonial knowledge. Even Ross has pointed out this lack many times. The contention about ceremonial knowledge is that healing and witchery are two things not so different from one another, and when ceremonial knowledge is coupled with alcohol, good judgment might lapse, and great or petty revenge for great or petty reasons might be taken on people, particularly in-laws. On the other hand, Ross and his family had land. Even now, they have more land than all of the other families in Crystal. The loss of family property was a major concern, as it always is when people marry. Despite the ballyhoo, Ross and Rachel married. Whether the occasion was joyous or celebratory is not known by me or by anyone I know. Ross might remember, but he is reluctant to talk to anyone about the event. With the marriage, much land, perhaps too much land, for Rachel brought land into the marriage too, came under the control of two people. After a brief time, all the usual things involved in starting a family happened. Children and more children and several more children. In the end, there were 17 of us. Somewhere along the way, perhaps because Ross and Rachel were prosperous, he worked at the tribal sawmill and she wove rugs, they were accused of witchery. These accusations came from both Ross and Rachel's relatives. I cannot say with certainty that they are false or that they are true. It is likely that they are partially true and partially false. My elder brothers and sisters know something about this time in Ross and Rachel's lives, but they will not discuss the matter. I do not know why they are secret. It is something I will never know. Again, I think this is because people often behave badly. this is a work from a longer essay, so I'm going to be switching back and forth a bit. Ross's relatives, his father, his mother, his brother, his sisters, are people who are largely unknown to me. On the BIA census card, there are 12 siblings listed and only one father and only one mother. Of these 12, I know two personally, Grace and Alvin. I have met others, Jerry and Tom. One of these two is the eldest. Jerry moved from Crystal a long time ago. Tom moved from Crystal a long time ago. I understand this need to remove oneself from family and Crystal. The first became a Mormon and lived as a farmer. The other followed the Native American church and lived as a rancher. I cannot tell you much else about these individuals. This is just as well. They do not concern me in any meaningful way. They are Ross's brothers. They belong to him. They are my uncles only because someone pointed out this fact of biology, this construct of culture to me, and I accepted it. This is not true with Alvin and Grace. These two people I have come to respect in a very limited and reserved manner. I have accepted them as uncle and aunt, not as individuals who are related to me by biology, by culture. I have accepted them because they were present in my youth. They were present with horses to ride and ginger snap cookies to eat. Now, understand this. What I just said, I know, is a sentimental recollection. I understand it is nostalgic, yet it is a true statement. As with all things, there is the other version. Thank you, Cameron, for that line today. Ross's sibling can be unmerciful in their cruelty. Here is this. After a brief visit to Crystal, I transported Grace back to Gallup, New Mexico, where they are residents in an adult care center. A nursing home, really. On the way there, she advised me on various matters in my life. Money, a home, a vehicle, a marriage, livestock. These are usual matters which concern an aging now for a woman like Grace. Excuse me. Of course, this is something I am assuming. I really do not know what concerns a person like Grace. Still, Grace's speech, the directive of it, the commandment of it, the do this and to do this and only this way of it, was familiar. For she and her brothers, Ross and Alvin, have recited this litany as to us, their children, many times. Some of us listened and some of us did not. In litany's praise, let me just repeat it. Some of us listened and some of us did not. We just did not. This particular speech is never nice to hear because, like all things Grace and Ross and Alvin say, they say it in the Navajo language, and the Navajo language bears the strength and sting of strict authority. Each time I hear the speech, I am humble. This humbling happens because the reality I know, the reservation I know best, has survived from one decade to the next because of those things. God, I need a drink. Why did they give us water? While transporting Aunt Grace back to Gallup, she commented along with all the other things which concerned her that I should leave alcohol alone, that I should have other drugs, that I should leave drugs alone. I did not agree and I did not disagree. I nodded. I acknowledged her. Then she said this: all your maternal relatives, the Tohunas, died because of alcohol. Rachel's family. This translation, the English of it, carries no meaning for me, really. Yet to hear the same thing in Navajo means this: the Tohunas, your mother's sister, your mother's father, your mother's grandmother, were drunks who drank themselves to an early death. There is more to what Aunt Grace said. To have your elders, particularly your maternal elders, abandon you is a source of shame and disgrace. This abandonment in this specific way is notoriously shameful and notoriously disgraceful. I thought to myself, oh, why could not my maternal relatives have been drunks who lived long lives? The things: money, home, vehicle, marriage, livestock, alcohol, drugs, which concern Grace and her brothers, do not concern me, or they concern me in a very limited way. I earn a small income. I am a teacher. I do not own a home. I live in an apartment. I drive my sister's vehicle. I am not married. I cannot stand livestock. I drink more than my share of liquor. I use drugs when I can afford them. These things do not concern me. They concern Grace, they concern Ross, they concern Alvin. They concern people other than myself. Yet and yet again, there is this contradiction. The things my Aunt Grace said about being abandoned by my maternal relatives sort of wounded me. My Aunt Grace does not understand this thing she said. It might hold hurtful meaning to Ross and his other children, but it does not hold hurtful meaning for me because my maternal relatives were shadows. Aunt Grace and Uncle Alvin were the visible ones in my life, and her stinging comments placed something between us. I am not sure what this something is, but as before, it sort of wounded me, but only sort of. Although Aunt Grace's comments were cruel, I did not respond in a cruel way as I regularly do to people, particularly my own family. Instead, an effort not to throw Grace out of my vehicle and leave her stranded by the highway in her wheelchair. I decided that for the remainder of the week, Grace would no longer be my aunt. Instead, Grace would be would be Ross's sister. Okay, I'm sweating for that. Several years ago, a medical doctor diagnosed Ross as having various ailments. That is the word he used, the doctor. The principal one being prostate cancer. I suppose prostate cancer qualifies as an ailment. My eldest sisters, Teresa and Charlene, my brother Richard, and I were present when the doctor informed us of this. The particular doctor smiled, nodded to us, and made the cordial gesture of inviting us to sit down. We sort of smiled back, did not nod, and were too uncomfortable to sit down. Why we were uncomfortable entails many things. My sisters Teresa and Charlene are the first of these uncomfortable things. My sisters do not like each other very much, and disliking not liking each other goes back further than I can remember, and the source of their disagreement is the thing I cannot know. These two sisters grew up in almost the same way. They were their parents' and grandparents' companion, which is to say they learned good and bad habits from three sets of people. Somewhere in between learning good and bad habits, they were shown a way of life on which to model their lives, including how to conduct themselves. I find this important and valuable, for not many people can claim the same thing, certainly not many of the people I know. In the course of all of this, they were schooled on the reservation, then sent away to live with Mormons until they graduated from high school. These two sisters, as well as others, took responsibility for me at various times in my life when Ross could not. He could not take responsibility for me at these various times for all the usual single-parent reasons. Somewhere along the way, the bad thing between Teresa and Charlene happened, from which bad feelings like resentment and envy resulted. I suppose their upbringing should have circumvented the event, though this is not altogether true. The model they had for sisters and the way in which sisters were supposed to relate and treat one another was not a good one. The model they had was Rachel and Marie and Flora. Rachel's the woman who brought us into the world, and Marie and Flora are her sisters. These three sisters are a separate story. Let it suffice, as far as I know, these three sisters did not treat one another very well. All this, my sister's distaste for one another. All this, my sister's distaste for one another, the mystery reason behind the distaste, and the bad behavior of their mother and aunts had accumulated over the years, and I saw it in the examination room where the doctor was cordial to us. My sisters did not greet each other and remain apart. Ross is aware of my sister's feeling toward each other. Perhaps he has spoken to them about their bad behavior and they chose to ignore him. This is perhaps why he overlooks the matter altogether. He has a Navajo word for it. It is a word which states the act and carries the inflection of bitterness. Ross's indifference to the matter did not ease the unpleasantness. There is this other thing of unpleasantness. From the moment a medical doctor examined a Navajo, medical doctors have told Navajo people bad things about themselves. Perhaps they are true things, perhaps they are not true things. The point is they did not have to be quite so ruthless in the diagnosis and quite so rude in the prognosis. Soon after this initial meeting, a bright someone formulated the overall bad concept of a hospital to serve Navajo people. As with some ideas conceived to benefit us, the idea of a place became a reality of such a place. From the beginning, there has never been comfort in the idea of such a place, and there is no comfort in the reality of such a place. None at all. All this discomfort makes me wish very hard for all these things and people who created them to go poof and disappear. This is not the kind of wish one has when one sees a pink velour hat in a mercantile window and remark out loud, "I wish I owned that pink hat." My wish is serious. If my wish were granted, my food would taste better. Yet again, reality, like it always does, remains. When I choose, I might glimpse this reality in the melodramatic mood of Navajo people while they watch soap operas on a television mounted awkwardly to a wall. I might even allow myself to see it in the scent of curtain windows and waxed hallway floors and the squeaks of people who populate the wards as they go about dispensing poor medical care, dismissing Navajo people's idea about the human body. I might see the very same thing very clearly in the bland colored folders upon which our names and hospital numbers are inscribed. With no air conditioning and not much of anything else, the place resembles something bleak and unforgiving, like a setting of a standard independent film. What can my people do but give it a chance? Likewise, how can it not be? For Ross, hospitals are bad places. They've always brought only disappointment. When he was a young man, government doctor official types came to the reservation to recruit young men to serve in the armed forces during one conflict or another. I think this particular scrap was World War II. They set up temporary hospitals to conduct physical examinations of the young men who wished to sign up for military service. As part of this process, the examiners had to draw blood for some good reason or another. When Ross had his blood extracted, the sight of his own blood was something he did not expect. He fainted. Of course, soldiers who faint at the sight of blood can never be a good thing. Thus, he was refused entrance into the military. I am glad of this. My eldest brother went to war and did not return in good shape. You see, there's never been a time when a hospital or a hospital somebody, or even worse, a temporary hospital or a temporary hospital somebody has said, "Ross, you're healthy as a horse." Although this might not be a benevolent thing to say, for horses on the reservation I know best are malnourished or get clunked by vehicles, sometimes both. Then there was the task of informing Ross of his condition and its entanglements. My sisters and brother glanced at one another, for even they, who are fluent in the Navajo language, were at loss for the word prostate. They knew the Navajo word for cancer. For cancer is not a new thing to Navajo people. Cold War uranium mining did this thing cancer to Navajo people and is a thing that has not ended. And so after a while of silence, my brother elected to tell my father of his condition. My sisters excused themselves to the lobby. I stuck around for a moment, then left because I could not stand there while Richard said to him something like, "You have prostate cancer. This is a very bad thing. It will make your life not fun. One of these not fun things is that you will soon lose the ability to have an erection." For a man like Ross, who produced 17 or more children, who enjoyed virility and its advantages, there is a measurable loss in such a statement. And so, like the other days Ross confronted a hospital and its personnel, this particular visit came to a bad end. He was made aware of his cancer. It was an ailment neither the hospital nor the doctor could cure. So they sent him home with his eldest daughter still not liking each other. If you get the impression I know Ross through speculation, events, and other people, it is true. He and I cannot communicate in a clear manner. I speak a language, English, he hardly understands or speaks. He speaks a language Navajo I understand well, but do not speak. In fact, I find it difficult to follow Navajo as other people speak it. The Navajo Ross speaks and the Navajo other people speak are often different. His vocabulary is larger and clearer, and the vocabulary of other people is not. This is not condescension or prejudice. It is simply an observation. You see, when two people, strangers, cannot speak to one another and ask questions like, "Which subway rail would be best to catch if I wish to see the heart of Manhattan?" because one does not understand the other's language, it is a very small inconvenience. This very small inconvenience between a father and a son, such as Ross and I, is an entirely different thing. I say thing because I cannot call it a problem. A problem is a set of difficult circumstances a human being is made to suffer while it resolves itself. I cannot call it a barrier. A barrier can be moved or hurdled or kicked over if it really is necessary. Since it will not resolve itself, or nor can I remove it by physical force, I cannot call this thing a problem or a barrier, so it remains a thing. I suppose it is a good thing we cannot communicate effectively with one another, for there are occasions on which I might say cruel and bad things to him. I might say cruel and bad things during the most inappropriate times. Then again, I might say nice and wonderful things. This autumn, while waiting to assist my brother Richard, or something or other, Ross ordered me to release his flock. In the Navajo language, an order is unmistakable. At my age, I found his order irritating. It was irritating because I did not own any sheep in the flock. Various siblings of mine do, but they are not around to care for their animals. Begrudgingly, I went to the sheep corral and let his flock out to graze. As my family's sheep rushed out, the small number of them brought about a sorrowful feeling. In my youth, when I was bothered by my family to assist with caring for the sheep, there were a great number more of them. Now there are a few ewes and fewer goats. At that moment, there seemed little promise for a successful lambing season. The conundrum regarding how I felt about Ross's dwindled flock and my small part in their care and existence added more irritation. Had I been able to speak the Navajo language, I might have been able to communicate to Ross my irritation. I might have been able to communicate my slight sorrow. There are moments Ross appears calm and heroic. Other times he is exasperating and disruptible. There are times, these are the times I like him least because he is at that moment a cliche. Then there are moments when he is something else altogether. This is what I mean. Late one afternoon, upon his return from his daily routine of eating at the senior citizens' noon meal program, most likely macaroni and cheese, driving 10 miles to the local United States post office to find nothing and accomplishing all the things involved in this routine, he asked me to accompany him. We drove to a certain spot on the highway where his flock regularly escaped the confines of the barbed wire fence erected to keep domestic animals like themselves from straying onto the highway. "I do not like doing this thing, shepherding his flock. I do not like it for sound reasons, but namely because I am not a shepherd." Still, I dutifully exited his truck and rounded up the strays and herded them back through the barbed wire fence. When I had finished, I turned around and saw Ross stooped over, examining something on the highway shoulder. He then tucked his cane under his arm and hopped. Yes, hopped a few steps. I walked faster to see what he was doing. He did it again, hop. When I near him, I saw he was imitating or mocking a grasshopper, which one I cannot say with certainty. Perhaps the grasshopper tired of the game, or perhaps I scared it off. Whatever the case, it took flight. Ross watched it disappear into the sagebrush. He placed his cane back beneath him. I do not know what he thought he was doing or if he made a conscious decision to do what he did. I do know this, though. He smiled and frowned at himself and ignored me as he climbed back into his truck. At these moments, he is an ordinary human being, perplexed at his ordinary human desires and confused by his ordinary human actions. I like him best when he is this, an ordinary human being. Thanks.